Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Christina Millar, one of the hosts of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Rebecca Kissane and Dr. Sarah Winslow, authors of Whose Game? Gender and Power in Fantasy Sports, published in 2020 by Temple University Press. Dr. Rebecca Kissane is an associate professor of sociology at Lafayette College and editor-in-chief of Sociology Compass. Her research areas include race, class, and gender, sociology of sport, social policy, nonprofit organizations, and urban sociology. Dr. Sarah Winslow is the Senior Associate Director of the Honors College, Director of the National Scholars Program, and Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Criminal Justice at Clemson University. Her research interests include gender, paid labor, higher education, work-family intersections, and fantasy sports. Dr. Kissane, Dr. Winslow, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah, so could we begin the interview by both of you saying a few words about yourself?
Sure, I'll start. So as you mentioned, I'm a sociologist. I'm at Lafayette College in an anthropology and sociology department. Throughout my research career, I focused on issues of social inequality, as you also mentioned. Most of my earlier research has focused on women in poverty, and in particular, their use of social service organizations, how they navigated welfare programs and policies in poor neighborhoods, particularly after the 1996 welfare reform legislation. But I've also more recently tackled this area of sociology of sports and still focusing on social issues of social inequality, in particular gender in this book, but also looking at issues of race and class. And so that's kind of, the book has kind of come out of a lot of the interest in social inequality issues, but I've kind of taken a departure in moving towards this sociology of sports angle.
And as you mentioned, this is Sarah. I'm a faculty member at Clemson University, and for the past several years have had primarily an administrative role at the university, helping to direct our Honors College and directing our top merit scholarship program. Most of my research has been broadly in sociology of gender, and specifically how gender operates in institutions and institutional contexts. So my work started out with a focus on gender in families. And I've done a significant amount of research since then on gender in higher education, particularly how faculty members use their time and how they allocate that time across the various domains of faculty careers and the work involved, teaching, research, service, with a particular attention to gender inequality in time allocation. And I'm still doing work in that area as a co-PI of Clemson's NSF Advanced Grant. And this project was an opportunity to tackle a different realm, a different institutional context by looking at how gender operates in sports.
Nice. So how did you two come to write Whose Game, and what inspired you to write this book?
So I'll start with that. So I have been playing fantasy sports now for quite some time, and I've always had a huge interest in sports as a regular fan. So I grew up in New Jersey and South Jersey and have always been a huge Philadelphia sports fan myself. I started playing fantasy sports maybe 15 years ago now at this point, or I guess more than that, maybe 20 years ago, when my brother was in a league and needed some additional players with him and his friends. And so I started playing fantasy sports, and I started out with just this one league in football, and I started to then expand that and started playing fantasy baseball, fantasy golf. I tried fantasy ice hockey for one season. And as I was playing, as a sociologist, I started really thinking, well, why am I finding this so enjoyable, first of all, as a sports fan? And then I also started to get interested in whether my experience as a woman player was generalizable to others. And so I started to think, well, maybe I'll do a little study on fantasy sports. and see if I can find out a little bit more about the hobby, find out more how gender and race and ethnicity and class might relate to who plays and the experience of playing it. And so I decided to launch this study. And at the time, I was thinking I might want someone else to join the project. And Sarah and I actually went to graduate school together and have been friends for a very long time. And so when I was thinking of people who might be interested in tackling this strange new project on fantasy sports, I thought maybe Sarah might be interested. And so I turned to her to see if she would be interested in joining the project. And thankfully she was.
Yeah, so I'll pick up there. I'm actually not a fantasy sports player. And I think that has been, it was a good thing for the project. Rebecca clearly brought so much background knowledge of fantasy sports as a player and as a fan. And that was really helpful. But there were times where, as we all know, you know, good sociology is sort of asking the questions and thinking sort of outside yourself in other ways. And I could do that, I think, a lot more easily because this was outside of my day-to-day experience. And so I think in writing the book, even, we'd be drafting things and I would see phrases that I wasn't familiar with and would point out ways that we were probably going to need to clarify things and it could bring a sort of different set of eyes to it. And as Rebecca mentioned, you know, in some ways this book is the product of a 20-year friendship. And, you know, when your friends call and have crazy ideas, you say yes. And I was really interested in the gendered elements of fantasy sports and the extent to which, as a sports fan, you know, we know there's a lot of gender inequality in quote unquote regular sports. And so I was interested in seeing whether that carried over into a context where some of the justifications for gendering physical sports are no longer there. And that sort of was the genesis, as Rebecca noted. We sort of thought, oh, we'll write an article or two. And I think it was, oh, a couple years, maybe into the project where we looked at each other, maybe even sooner than that, maybe at our first conference, now that I think back to it, and we sort of looked at each other and we're like, this is a book, isn't it? And neither one of us had ever written books. So that also was a new challenge for both of us.
Yeah, I love that story. And I really enjoyed the book. It's different. And I had never read about fantasy sports before. So I learned a lot. So for listeners who also may not be familiar with fantasy sports, what is fantasy sports and sort of how does it work and how popular is this hobby?
So I'll jump in and take that one. And I think the important point to clarify here is that, you know, in our book, we're focusing on traditional fantasy sports leagues. And what that means is that, you know, we're focused on everyday players, sort of everyday individuals who in fantasy sports lingo are called managers. And they build virtual sports teams that include real life athletes. And those athletes accumulate points based on their performance in actual sporting events. And as Rebecca mentioned and talking about her experience, you know, these are typically professional men's football, baseball, ice hockey, basketball, and they accumulate these points over the course of the traditional or normal sports season. And so to give you an example, if you're a manager in a fantasy football league, you might roster the quarterback of the New Orleans Saints. You might have a running back from Arizona Cardinals. You'd have a kicker from a different team, perhaps. And you would assemble as a manager your team, and that team competes in a league that usually consists of 10 to 14 teams compiled by other managers. And all those teams have sort of different assortments of real players. Fantasy sports kind of started, decades ago, well before the rise of technology, but now with the rise of internet and various platforms, it really has become increasingly popular, so that the estimates are that close to 60 million people play in the United States and Canada alone. And that's about a sixfold increase since just 2005.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's a really popular hobby. And that's good because you had a lot to draw off of for the study. So tell us a little bit about the methods that you used to conduct this study and the experience of conducting this research. I'm especially interested in your experience, Rebecca, given that you play fantasy sports and you have for a long time.
Yeah. So it's a mixed and multi-method project. So there's both quantitative and qualitative data, and there's multiple types of qualitative data that we draw on for the book. In all, I'd say that there's probably, you could break down the data into four different sets of data. And so, as Sarah already mentioned, where our focus is on traditional fantasy sports league, and most of the data we collected are really focused on getting information from those everyday players and their perspective and their experiences and views on fantasy sports. And so the two probably biggest parts of the data that we draw on is the online survey that we did and the qualitative interviews. And so the online survey had both open-ended and closed-ended questions. So we're able to do some statistical analysis with the closed-ended questions and then also do some qualitative open coding with the open-ended questions. And in all, 453 people completed the survey. The vast majority, close to 400, were individuals who self-identified as either currently playing fantasy sports or having had played at some point in the past. So there were some non-players in that sample, and we do draw on that a little bit in the book. But most of our focus is really on those 400 or so people who said that they currently or formerly had played fantasy sports. And then to get more in-depth information from players, I also conducted interviews with 47 fantasy sports players, 30 of whom were men and 17 were women. And then in addition to that, there's two other smaller sets of data that we incorporate in the book. The first is we did a content analysis of fantasy sports message boards and chat forums. So basically, for those who aren't familiar, there are all these online spaces where people who are playing fantasy sports can go and pose questions related to the specific, you know, rosters they have about who should I play today in this matchup or something like that and get advice. But there's also these chat forums where people are kind of going on, and it might have started because of this fantasy sports involvement to ask a question like that, but then it evolves into people talking about a whole host of other stuff in sports or media or anything else. And so we looked at some off topics sections of those forums, and then also some of the kind of other forums, like just daily chatting forums about fantasy sports, and analyze those data. And then the last set of data is Sarah and I did ethnographic research at a fantasy sports trade conference. And those data basically are qualitative data based on our observations at the conference. The conference was about a 3-day affair, and the conference really is one that's focused at the industry people. So it's a lot of people in sports media, as people who are trying to sell various products or market to fantasy sports players. And it's also the industry itself and how they're kind of framing fantasy sports was a lot of what we were interested in finding out when we attended that conference. And so these are kind of the power players, if you will, of the fantasy sports industry. And so in looking at the data we collected, our data in terms of the respondents very much mirrors the data in terms of who plays fantasy sports. So Sarah mentioned that it's a hugely popular hobby with close to 60 million people playing. But what's also important to keep in mind is that fantasy sports players, those everyday players, typically are pretty privileged in terms of their socioeconomic backgrounds. And so they are typically white, they're typically upper and middle class in terms of their education levels and in terms of their incomes. They also tend to be kind of in that range of 25 to 45 or 50 years old. They tend to be married. Fortunately, our sample of respondents mirrors that. And so we're able to, we think, really speak to kind of that typical average player who also happens to be relatively privileged in terms of their economic background. And so in terms of like the experience of conducting the research, as Sarah mentioned, in some ways, you know, we have some outsider status here, right? So, you know, Sarah was an outsider in the sense that she didn't play fantasy sports. And that actually was super in terms of her being able to take a critical lens to the project, able to kind of focus on kind of how we discuss findings and seeing things that I may not have seen, because I am, as you've mentioned, someone who's played a long time and is really close to the data in a lot of ways. And that did give me some, you know, that was beneficial in a lot of ways to be so close, because I could speak the language, right? So when somebody was talking in the interviews about certain aspects of the play, I understood what they were talking about. I was able to build rapport with them very easily. I was able to recruit well for the study because I knew the outlets by that people would be using to get information about fantasy sports, and so I could advertise the study. And so that was really helpful. I'm also white. I'm highly educated. I'm a professional in terms of the work I do, as is Sarah. And so we were also able to kind of have a certain rapport with the respondents and understand the data in a way, because we kind of shared a lot of the same kind of background as a lot of the people who are participating. But I think what's really key is that, you know, Sarah and I are both women, and the majority of fantasy sports players are men. And so that actually created some opportunities and also perhaps some difficulties in the data collection process. So just as a couple examples, I found that on the chat forums that I was advertising the study, or some of the men I interviewed would often question my expertise. They'd ask questions like, you know, oftentimes the first question they say, why are you doing the study? Why are you out to get fantasy sports? Stuff like that. And so they were questioning the motives I had for doing the research. And so I found that I oftentimes had to do some explaining that I'm a sports fan. I like fantasy sports. I'm not trying to attack fantasy sports players. And because of that, I think sometimes some of the people might have responded to the survey in ways that were kind of defensive. Like they thought that I was trying to have these gotcha questions in the survey, which I wasn't. And I also think that probably because, especially again, for the men talking to me as a woman, there might have been some hesitancy to answer questions in certain, you know, because they were worried about being coming across as sexist or misogynistic or whatever. And so sometimes they would even kind of talk in ways to say, not to sound sexist, but, and then say something really sexist or something like that. And so that was kind of part of that experience that I had as a woman doing this research, is having this kind of questioning, which actually was kind of interesting because it told me something about, you know, the women's experiences playing in general, because here I am as a researcher and authority doing this research on sociology of sports, and I was still getting pushback from a lot of people in terms of what my motives were and whether or not I should even be doing this research. And so the positive of that was that in the interviews, I feel like I could understand directly oftentimes what the women respondents were feeling and what they were experiencing. And I think that they felt very comfortable talking about those issues that they were experiencing while they were playing in their leagues. And that really, I think, was super helpful in kind of not only in terms of the types of questions I was able to ask, but also how I was able to analyze the data and how I was able to see how my own position as a woman researcher who was also kind of upper middle class, I could see how that might be affecting how the data we collected, what the data was, but also what we were able to see and what we were arguing. And that made us, I think, the book a stronger book because we were able to think about that throughout the process.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to go ahead and jump right into the content of the book because there's so much good stuff here. So you talked about how sports are a site for the production, reproduction, and maintenance of gender and masculinity. So what traits are valued in the world of fantasy sports, and how does this connect to gender and masculinity?
So maybe I'll start with the general kind of background stuff, and then maybe Sarah can jump in and talk about the traits in fantasy sports and how they support kind of a gender project. You know, one thing that I think most people understand is that regular sports is very much tied to masculinity, right? And so it is, you know, regular sports, and by regular sports, I mean those sports that, you know, you actually go out and participate on a field of play, not fantasy sports, are, you know, definitely this site for, you know, producing what gender is, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, for reproducing previously understood notions of gender, for maintaining gender and gender hierarchies. And so, just as a little historical context, this idea of sports as being a key way of demonstrating manhood is pretty modern in the United States context. And Michael Messner, a sociologist, a sport scholar, has kind of argued that there was this crisis of masculinity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that really contributed to the rise of organized sports and physical activity as core leisure pursuits for men, but also core ways for men to demonstrate manhood. And won't go into detail on this, but a lot of what he talks about is how the world was really changing to that time. And, you know, men's labor was becoming more rationalized. And we had the urbanization and we had the closing of the frontier and we had other things going on. Women were asserting their power in different ways. And that all of that led to a lot of traditional male controlled forms of masculinity to be weakened. And so men were looking for new and additional ways to assert their manhood. And sports, organized sports in particular, developed during the late 19th and early 20th century as a way for men to be able to say, okay, we're physically more powerful than women. We're different than women, right? So it's supporting this kind of binary understanding of men and women as different and also very much opposed to one another. And it's a way to say that not only are we physically dominant, but we're also kind of mentally tough and things like that. And so organized sports do that for men. We talk about how sports for boys and men are basically requisite gender training. So men and boys are learning through organized sports what it means to be a man. They're learning that they should be sacrificing their bodies and using them as weapons. They're learning to be aggressive. They're learning to be mentally and physically strong, to be competitive, to be dominant over others. And that they're learning all these things. And as they're doing these things, they're reinforcing those very same things, that masculinity is being aggressive, is being mentally and physically strong, is being competitive. And they're also learning a key thing, that gender is about being different, right? So masculinity only makes sense in relation to femininity, and that men can assert manhood by saying, this is what we're not. We're not like those women. We're not weak. We're not fragile. We're not uncompetitive. And so sports provide this key way of doing that. And what's really interesting is that sports, not at this point, men don't need to play sports or embody these physical ideals to actually garner masculinity points. They can also get those kind of benefits of the athletic successes of pro athletes by just associating with them through things like, you know, becoming a sports fan and rooting and cheering for that sports team. And so by sitting on the couch, if they know a lot about sports, they can still reap those benefits, right? And so that's kind of just some of the larger context of that. And certainly it's a contested terrain still, because women are parts of real sports. They are fans, they're athletes. And so as women are participating, they're also pushing back on some of these notions of gender. And so that's kind of some background. And Sauer now can probably talk more specifically about what traits are valued in the world of fantasy sports and how that relates to some of these gender issues.
Yeah, so one of the things we do in the book is we sort of locate fantasy sports relative to what we know about, you know, traditional or regular sports, as Becky notes, the sports that you play, you know, or you're watching on TV, and also, you know, sort of position it as this newer type of fandom. And the interesting thing is that, to me, there's this paradox, right? Like, so on the one hand, fantasy sports fandom, it kind of broadens your fandom because you are paying attention to athletes on a variety of teams and that therefore games being played by a variety of teams. Because again, for the most part, people are drafting players across the league. But it's also a lot more individualized. Right. So my fandom isn't just about whether my team wins, right? But whether a person I have chosen, an athlete I have chosen to be on my fantasy sports team, you know, whether they do something good, they score points, they make a great tackle, and that then garners points for me. So there's this sense among players, we argue, that they're actually, there's a heightened level of control in fantasy sports. And in many ways, this can make it an even more sort of powerful way of demonstrating masculinity. So we highlight a number of traits that are really sort of central to this. One is the sort of exercising this sense of control over their fan experience. That by picking up a particular player, making a good trade, that as a player and a fan, I'm in control of that experience in a way that I'm not when I'm just watching my favorite sports team play. I haven't played a role in that. And that means also then the sense of accomplishment seems more personal and direct to our players. And this was a much more common thing we heard from the men, that they felt they got a sense of accomplishment from this activity. There's also a sort of premium on knowledge, sports knowledge. And as Rebecca notes, you know, this is something, because we associate sports with men and boys more so than women and girls, it's something that men are disproportionately likely to have and to have had developed throughout their lives. So men really place an emphasis on their success as being tied to their sports knowledge. And they sort of explain away losses by, you know, bad luck. Women are actually much more likely to admit that they don't have a whole lot of control over what happens. Yes, they've picked up particular athletes in their draft or off a trade, but at the end of the day, they can't control what happens in that real game any more than they could if they were just watching it and not as a fantasy sports participant. And so these become really important elements of sort of fantasy sports fandom in a way that we don't necessarily see in your average sports fandom.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to go ahead and talk about a term that you use in the book that I really like. You call it jockstastulinity, which kind of goes with the sports knowledge part and also the performing masculinity aspect of fantasy sports. So you argue that fantasy sports allows men to perform and accomplish this jockstastulinity. So what is this term and how do men use fantasy sports to accomplish this?
Sure. So jockstastulinity, it's a tough word to say.
Yeah.
It's one of these things that, that when we were analyzing the data, we saw a lot of evidence that, there were these kind of dimensions, these constellation of dimensions that, we were seeing that were coming together in terms of how men were talking about their fantasy sports experience and that related to masculinity. And so we kind of talk about it in the book as jockstastulinity as having three dimensions. And all of these dimensions are combined and support one and build upon one another. So they're not really separate. They kind of all come together to form this overarching kind of variant of masculinity or means of performing masculinity. And so the first dimension is very much similar to what Connell kind of talks about as hegemonic masculinity. And so this is a type of masculinity that really centers on one-upmanship, on competition, on athleticism, on aggression. And so the ways that this kind of is manifested in fantasy sports is that when men are talking about their fantasy sports experience and why they play fantasy sports, they're really often focusing on fantasy sports as a way to compete with one another and to beat them and to dominate over them. And so even though they're not, you know, putting on a pair of cleats and getting on a field of play like they might have in the past when they were younger or, you know, more able to in terms of time, they're still kind of using fantasy sports as a way to be to exhibit aggression against one another, to dominate others, to demonstrate that they are kind of highly competitive individuals. So that's one kind of dimension. A second dimension we talk about is that is more of a kind of a cerebral masculinity. And so this is the aspect of fantasy sports that involves being strategic, being technologically savvy, being rational, being really adept at statistics. And it's a type of masculinity that is associated with socioeconomic power, with intellectual prowess, with nerdiness even. And so a lot of what the men said to illustrate in terms of fantasy sports is that one of the things they love about fantasy sports is that it's that they get to compile all of these statistics on all these different on all these real life players and teams, and they get to digest that and they get to analyze it and they make their spreadsheets to figure out who's the best person to draft or whether it's time to drop that player and pick up another one. And they're also approaching the game in really strategic and depersonalized ways. And so one of the differences that we found in terms of how men and women in particular kind of construct teams and think about players is that while both men and women do emphasize picking players that are statistically going to give them the best chance at winning in their fantasy sports matchups, women much more so than men also consider other factors that we would say have nothing to do with performance per se, like whether or not someone is accused of raping somebody or whether or not somebody is a good person off the field of play, or those sorts of things, where the men really say, nope, the most important thing about fantasy sports is winning. And the way I'm going to do that is by using my smarts, my strategy, my ability to analyze statistics to win. And this is kind of that cerebral aspect of jocks-masculinity that we talk about in the book. And then the last dimension is kind of more of a boyhood masculinity. And so a lot of what fantasy sports talk about is that they like playing, fantasy sports players talk about is that they like playing because it's a way to get, be able to role play a dream of theirs as a child, to be a general manager of a sports team or a coach, or to be highly involved. And so they're using fantasy sports as kind of a way to harken back to childhood. Oftentimes they banter with one another in ways that are almost very childish. And so they're using that as a way to kind of escape from adult responsibilities and adult interactions. In particular, men often talk about using fantasy sports as a way to escape from work or escape from family responsibilities. And so we talk about this, the constellation of these kind of three elements of masculinity, like a hegemonic masculinity, a cerebral masculinity, a boyhood masculinity, as all kind of coming together in various ways for the players, and actually giving them opportunities to kind of assert their manhood and to reinforce their manhood in a way that might not be accessible to them in other ways, as they, again, are men who are aging and who are oftentimes disconnected from other ways of asserting their masculinity like they had in the past by actually playing a sport, for instance. And so it becomes this really potent way for men to demonstrate their masculinity, and more potent than regular fandom, as Sarah kind of suggested, because their achievements are more directly tied to the achievements of these real life professional athletes. And so this jocks-masculinity is really interesting because it's super potent and powerful for these men, but it's also pretty accessible, at least for these highly educated professional players who have the time and the resources to be able to delve into fantasy sports.
Yeah. So would you consider this or talk a little bit about how this is a form of hybrid masculinity or of fantasy sports as a way to gain vicarious masculinity? Do these concepts connect to this at all?
Yeah, sure. So Tristan Bridges and CJ Pascal have written a lot about hybrid masculinities. And, you know, the thing about hybrid masculinities is what they do is they kind of blend hegemonic masculinity with some elements of a marginalized or subordinated masculinities, and sometimes even components of femininity. And so this type of masculinity, and oftentimes expressions of hybrid masculinities, are very much limited to those who already are more powerful, right? Because they have, so white heterosexual men who have high economic power often are those that are able to take on these hybrid masculinities because they have the power that allows to embrace non-hegemonic ideals without suffering a lot of the negative ramifications of that. And so what we're arguing with jocks-masculinity is that it is in a lot of ways a hybrid masculinity because there is this embrace of hegemonic masculine traits, right? So there's a lot of this focus on dominance again and on control and aggression and one-upmanship and competition. But there's also this nerdy quality, right, that aligns it more with some subordinated masculinities, which again, when we think of that nerd, we might think of some elements of power, like a Bill Gates, right, who has a lot of economic power and people might aspire to be him, but we don't think of them as physically dominant or aggressive, right, like we do with the hegemonic male. And so it is a form of hybrid masculinity in that sense, where there are these hegemonic qualities, but there's also this highly nerdy quality that are kind of merged together and enable men who, again, previously might not have been able to be seen as this kind of aggressive, tough man because they were not very athletic, or maybe now they can't because they're injured or older. And this allows them to achieve this kind of masculinity through a different way, through knowing the sports statistics and through being able to analyze sports in this kind of more nerdy way. And then this then does tie it to this idea of vicarious masculinity, because they're, again, connecting real-life athlete successes to their own in direct ways and gaining masculinity points for doing so, right? So by being that person who is really adept at fantasy sports, men are signaling in some ways that they are just like those guys on the field. They're real men who are able to be dominant and to win and to compete at a high level, even though they themselves aren't the ones actually playing the game.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I want to jump to something you mentioned in answering the question is time and how socioeconomic status and privilege and sort of access to the higher knowledge that you need to do statistics or have time to really sit down and engage with fantasy sports. So how is participation in fantasy sports related to time and work and encroaching on like leisure time and household and their work lives? I'm really interested in, because it sounds like fantasy sports takes a lot of time. So how do men incorporate this, and how do they justify taking this time away from other aspects of their life?
I'll go ahead and jump in there. So I think one thing that's really important to remember, as Rebecca's, you know, mentioned, is that people who play fantasy sports are disproportionately, you know, highly educated professionals. And that means that they're in the types of occupations which give them a lot more control over their time use, a lot more flexibility. It's sort of, in some ways, you know, this is particularly timely to be talking about it, right? For the types of people who have jobs that allow them to work from home when we need to be out of our offices. But just in general, they have more freedom throughout the day. And so we heard a lot from our respondents about how their fantasy sports play is, we'll say, integrated into their work days even, right? That while the vast majority claimed, at least, that it wasn't distracting, that it wasn't taking time away from work, they often pointed out to us that they would do it during downtimes. You know, so they might, if they work in a lab, for example, have a downtime while something, you know, experiments running or something, while they were waiting on a call, and they would maybe, you know, do some rostering or read some articles. And it's also important to remember that this requires technology and access to it. And so this is obviously much easier for people who spend their day sitting in front of a computer, or at least with easy access to their phones. So that was a really important piece of how class played into the fantasy sports story and people's time use around it. Now, in terms of the sort of work family side of things, you know, we did see that men were more likely than women to both use it as an escape from family and report things that indicated that they were perhaps working on their fantasy sports play, whether that was, you know, manipulating their lineups or watching games and monitoring things at times when women might be likely to be, you know, having responsibilities for childcare. And there were even a few men who were like, wow, you know, I don't know what I'd do if I, you know, had to be putting my kids to bed or something like that. So there was this kind of interesting way in which time use was embedded with this. And while there certainly are some people who spend a lot of time, you know, this was true even for people who reported not spending a, you know, inordinate amount of time in terms of total number of hours on fantasy sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I also want to talk about women's participation in fantasy sports. You've talked a lot about men's participation, but of course you also had women in your study. So why do men think that women are less likely to play fantasy sports? And can you talk just in general about women's participation in fantasy sports?
Sure. So I'll tackle the first part about kind of these abstract views about why women don't play. Mm-hmm. And then Sarah can pick up and talk about what women's experiences who did play actually were. So just kind of as background, as we kind of alluded to before, fantasy sports are predominantly played by men. So at the time when we collected our data, it was about 30% of players were women. What's kind of interesting is that now it's a lower percentage. So in 2019, I just looked up the figures. It's now about 19% of players are women. So there's actually a declining percentage of fantasy sports players who are women, which is pretty interesting in and of itself. But when we asked the players why they think women are less likely to play, what was interesting, both men and women kind of reflected similar ideas, right? So in terms of thinking about it, they held very stereotypical ideas of what men and women are and what they should be. And they also had very dichotomous views of men and women as vastly different and opposed to one another. And so when they were talking about why in general women don't play, they would often say that women in general don't find real sports important. They don't find them interesting. Women don't have knowledge or experience playing with sports. And so they had a very gendered vision of athletic participation and a very gendered vision of sports fandom. They also would then assert that women, instead of being interested and knowledgeable of sports, were more interested in other sorts of obligations that were highly feminine. So they would talk a lot about, like, you know, women were more interested in decorating or shopping or cooking or raising their kids or kind of nurturing others in various ways. Sometimes they talked about things like women were into book clubs and reading and not into this kind of these other sorts of pursuits. And related to that is that there was often a discussion that women in general are not very competitive. And so their interests would lie in things that were non-competitive pursuits like a book club rather than playing in a competitive game like fantasy sports. And they often would say, again, that women were not very statistically oriented, that women and men are different. Men are strategic and statistical and smart, and women weren't. And that's why they weren't interested in playing fantasy sports. And so what's interesting is when we analyze these abstract views of why women and men were not, why women weren't playing fantasy sports as much as men, what we found is that they, both men and women, would often reduce these decisions to not play as individual preferences that were biologically rooted, that naturally men and women were different. And therefore they chose to not participate because they didn't want to. And what that ignores, obviously, is that a lot of these decisions and interests are structurally determined, right? So women, what the respondents would often say, women are just interested in tending to their families and not having hobbies like this, where in reality, women are pushed into having to do family responsibilities. And that's why they're not, and not so much of this unconstrained choice that is the way the players often framed women's non-participation. And then also, women often can't play because they're not asked to join leagues as much. You know, so when men have open slots in their fantasy sports leagues for one reason or another, they assume women aren't interested in playing, right? And therefore, they don't ask them to play. So it's oftentimes hard for women to even who have an interest and a predisposition or whatever to join, to be able to join a league. So in terms of these abstract views, in terms of why we found that women were less, the views of why women were less likely to play, we often see stuff that you would expect, that women aren't playing because they're not interested in sports, because they have other more feminine pursuits, because they're not competitive, they're not statistically oriented, and because they just really want to stay home and tend to their families, right? And so that's what we heard a lot of about. And then, so these kind of abstract views in a lot of ways frame the way that women who do play actually experience the hobby. And so Sarah can talk more about that now.
Yeah. And I think the important point to also underscore, as Rebecca notes, right, there's all these sort of stereotypical and abstract ideas of what women like or want or are good at. And then women who do play, right, confront not only those abstract views, but also this context that we've been talking about that emphasizes competition and dominance and winning, that isn't just about individual men's behaviors, but it's that that becomes the institutionalized frame for what a fantasy sports player does and is, looks like, right? So that the entire context is masculinized. And so women, you know, sort of confront this. And one of the first things this means, much like what, you know, Rosabeth Moss Kanter, you know, taught us decades ago about the experiences of tokens, is that, you know, women are highly visible, right? Sometimes men, you know, directly remark at their sex, their gender, their minority status, right? Like, oh, you know, you're such a girl, or just pointing out that they're women. They also face scrutiny. And they get the sense that men use a different set of standards to judge their behavior and their attitudes than they would for players who are men. So we had some, you know, respondents say, you know, it felt like every move I made, you know, if I dropped somebody, if I picked somebody up, people looked at it differently. And there's this great quote, you know, where a woman talks about how, I feel like when I do things, you know, people look at it differently. They scrutinize it. And if I was a man, you know, it would be like, oh, that's so interesting. I wonder what made him choose that player, right? Maybe he knows something that I don't, right? But as a woman, when I do that, that's a strange pick, or something that maybe doubts, cast doubt on her confidence. And while we didn't see a lot of examples of really overt and hostile sexism in everyday play, and I think it's important to note that most players, we talk about how women experience their fantasy sports play, most people are playing with known others. And so those experiences did mean that we saw a lower reported level of really hostile sexism outside of the context of, say, anonymous fantasy sports boards and chat rooms, where there was a lot more of that. But some women did talk about, you know, men, you know, being kind of jerks. And, you know, again, like I said, public forums definitely much more than others. Sometimes what happened in contexts in leagues where people were playing with family and friends and was that women felt like they actually experienced what might be akin to benevolent sexism, that is like protection from the most, the worst of the smack talking, which was one of the behaviors that men, interactional behaviors that men did to sort of do masculinity in this context, that women were often protected from that. And, you know, we argue that known others might feel the need to kind of shield women in ways that strangers don't. But in shielding women, again, they're also being positioned as women and not just as players, right? That does kind of highlight one's gender in this context. Women also reported kind of being looked down upon, being seen as easy wins, right? So guys sometimes joking like, hey, you know, can I get in that league of yours that's predominantly women or all women, you know, because basically I'd like to win and I'm assuming it's going to be easier. Sometimes women were met with condescension or uninvited assistance, that they got the sense that the men they played with thought that they weren't as smart, that they needed more assistance, that they didn't know sports as well, again, reflecting this larger frame that suggests that men are the ones who are knowledgeable in this context. And then there's a lot of sort of reflection on the sense that women might be more relationship-driven than men. Sometimes this looked like women being accused of drafting people based on romantic desire, that is, you know, drafting Tom Brady because, you know, he's cute, as opposed to the fact that, you know, he's an outstanding quarterback. the presumption that women would put their relationships over their competition, the sense of competition, so that in a given week, you're often put most, a lot of leagues are structured that you're head to head with another team in a given week. And the assumption that if the woman was playing against her closest friend, she might not try as hard, right? That they wouldn't want to beat each other. And then sometimes this relational kind of element was the suggestion that women were playing fantasy sports like kind of as a dating service. They weren't really interested in playing fantasy sports or in the sports aspect of it. They were there to meet men. And then also sometimes lots of assessment when women won, right? This was often met with hesitation by men, either, really disappointed men being really disappointed that they had lost to a woman, or because of that, some explaining away of women's success. And one big way that women's success was explained away was on the presumption that, again, because fantasy sports are virtual and we're not engaging in these physical behaviors that people are watching us do as on a field of play, that when women won, it was because their husbands or their boyfriends were actually playing fantasy sports for them, making their roster decisions, making their, setting their lineups and things like that.
It sounds like there's really interesting ties here to things like social capital and social networks, as well as exclusionary practices, whether that's overt or covert, and then also sexuality. Like that, it's an interesting comment you made about, oh, women choose Tom Brady because he's cute. Like that's such an integral part of like women and their presumed interests. And are there any ties there to like homophobia?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's clearly a very sort of heterosexualized assumption built in. And for sure, we didn't hear a lot of homophobic comments necessarily, but a lot of men's posturing with other men, as we know, throughout the masculinity literature, and we see it here too, that men's posturing with other men often invokes femininity and homophobia, right? This gendered homophobia. So when men were kind of trash talking with other men, they might refer to those men as girls, right? So a lot of this is kind of fundamentally heterosexualized, and we see it here as an example in sort of women's presumed motives and behaviors are driven by this assumption, or just couched in this assumption, that these women are heterosexual. And we also do make the argument, much as we noted with men and Becky when she was talking about sort of hybrid masculinities and who is in a position to integrate in that case, elements of marginalized masculinities, that it requires a certain status to do that. Another point we make is that when we do see women kind of pushing against these assumptions about what it means to be a woman in this arena, sort of claiming what you might call elements of transformative agency, right? Like claiming like, yeah, I'm a woman and I'm good, and just sort of get used to it. That in this was a case in which women's presumed heterosexuality could aid them in making that argument, right? That it was women who were white and upper middle class and highly educated and had at least presumed to be heterosexual, that were in a better position actually to make some of the claims that might transform the gender order in the space.
Yeah, sure. So before we wrap up, I want to hear from both of you, because I think you'll have interesting perspectives that might be very different. What surprised you most about your research findings?
We're both silent. I think that for me, I think that what was interesting was that how much men and women, for that matter, were pretty silent on a lot of the issues that we saw really apparent in the when we were analyzing the data, meaning that we talk about how gender is basically so pervasive in this space, and also some race and class dimensions as well. And there was not much discussion of that, you know, like, so while it was kind of like for Sarah and I, like, you know, really highlighted, very evident as we were looking through this, when they're talking about various things, that they're really talking about gendered power in various ways, or talking about kind of class privilege, that players, and again, keep in mind that these are players who are very highly educated for the most part, are, you know, have gone to college, have probably taken courses on stuff related to the stuff, some of whom were college professors themselves, and they were pretty much not, you know, that these kind of things that seem so apparent to us were pretty much invisible. So it kind of speaks to me, like, how powerful kind of these dimensions of social inequality are in the space, but also how invisible they are to those that are immersed in it. So to me, I think I was expecting a little bit more, maybe especially from women, saying, hey, yeah, it's a real problem being women, it's a highly sexist space, blah, blah, blah. But what happened instead is sometimes women would say, yep, nope, there's, you know, everything's great, I'm treated as equal. And then they would have a litany of examples of the ways that they're underestimated, or the ways that they're made to feel lesser, or the ways that they have like these kind of exclusionary practices that they're experiencing. And you know, and so there's this kind of this ability to, or, you know, among men saying, I'm not sexist, but was this kind of very common phrase, you know, where there would be this kind of espousing of sexist values or opinions, and then not really acknowledging in any real way that what that actually means. So to me, I think that was surprising. I think I was expecting a little bit more kind of awareness, maybe, of some of the dimensions that we talk about in the book.
And I'll just, mine is somewhat similar, but also a little bit different. And I'll say that I can't say I was surprised, as somebody, you know, who's made a career out of studying gender. But I do think that what's interesting, particularly about this, is there are so many possibilities in this realm, for I don't want to say for this not to happen, but that's the best phrase I can come up with, right? For there to be something different about how gender is manifest and how gender inequality is reproduced, right? We're not in fantasy sports. Men and women are, or at least have the potential to be, playing against one another or with one another in a way that we don't see in, you know, traditional sports where they're largely sex segregated. And there's the potential to be anonymous. I mean, there's just sort of all these possibilities. And yet the sort of same patterns of gender inequality and the marginalization of women in particular, while we do see a little bit of opening up about what masculinity could look like for men, we don't see quite as much of that for women, except at the margins. And I think that's a really powerful statement about how sort of institutionalized current gender regimes are in all aspects of life.
Absolutely. And given that gender is so tied to sports in general, I imagine that these patterns are prevalent in other aspects of sports engagement, like selling sports memorabilia, or, you know, following teams. So I'm interested in learning more about that. But so we have taken up a lot of your time today. But my final question for you both is, what are you working on now or next?
I recently kind of launched a new research project where I'm tying together some more directly some of my interest in leisure and sports with my interests on women and poverty. And so what I'm currently working on is how low-income women and their families kind of use and think about their leisure times and the constraints and opportunities they encounter in their everyday lives to even have free time or and to their ability to use it in the ways that they might want to, and how this might connect to their overall well-being and to their ability to build social capital. So I'm also kind of interested in how and whether they use local neighborhood organizations to help connect them to resources they might need, like tangible resources, but also connect them to other individuals who then can be a source of enjoyment in their free time and things like that. So that's kind of what I'm looking at right now.
My academic appointment now is 100% administrative. So I spend a little bit less time on research than maybe I'd like to, or than most folks. But I do have an ongoing project as part of Clemson's NSF Advanced Grant, which, for those who aren't familiar, is a National Science Foundation grant program that targets issues of gender inequality and increasingly issues of race and other sort of marginalized faculty groups, particularly in STEM fields. And the focus of our institutions, it's an institutional transformation grant. So the goal is to make change at your institution around issues of gender and race in the faculty. And one of the foci of our grant project is on faculty time use. And so I am the social science research co-director and doing some work gathering time diaries on how faculty members use their time throughout the work week, and including the weekend, which is not something that we have much data on. So potentially there is some overlap there in that we are collecting data on how people use their time 24 hours a day for an entire week. And so we're capturing not just working time, but childcare, family time, and leisure time as well.
Sounds like interesting and very important projects, especially during this time where a lot of people are at home and experiencing a difference in their time use. And also, where can listeners find you online to learn more about your work and your book?
So obviously a lot of the information for the book can be found on Temple University's website. So that's a good place to go to get information on actually purchasing the book. More information about me can be found on my website, which you can be located from Lafayette College's Anthropology and Sociology page. And so my website can provide additional information about my research and also some of the other publications that have come out of this research project.
Great.
I would say similarly, you could find me on a faculty page on Clemson's website just by searching my name or linking through the Sociology, Anthropology, and Criminal Justice Department. And then Rebecca and I are also both on Twitter.
Great. Yeah, I'll include your Twitter handles in the post when we put up this podcast so listeners can find you and learn more. So again, this has been an interview with Dr. Rebecca Kassane and Dr. Sarah Winslow. I want to thank you again, both of you again, for being on the show today, and I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Christina.